Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio TV personality. Dedicated to empowering others through her mental skills, she also features authors and experts from all over the world to share their knowledge and experience with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna and her guests. Here's Donna.
Hello and welcome to an hour of mind power. This is Donna Sebo, and today I think we are going to be discussing a subject matter that to me is very dear to my heart. And I think for many of you that are listening today, you'll find it just as interesting and fascinating as I did. My guest today is Don Hoglund. His book is called Nobody's Horses, The Dramatic Rescue of the Wild Herd of White Sands, New Mexico. Don, welcome to the show.
Hi, Don. It's my pleasure to be here with you and to talk to you and your listeners about my favorite subject, the free-roaming horse.
Well, I'll tell you what. I have had all of my life, and I don't know why, because I'm not a horse woman. I think the only thing I ever rode was a few ponies when I was a little one. But I just have a love of these magnificent animals, and horses are so special. You're a doctor, a veterinarian, and you've worked with all kinds of people through the years. You've done consultation work and equine training services for the Pentagon, the Walt Disney Company, and a lot of others. And when I opened your book, the very first sentence in your book is, "From my perspective, there will never be an animal that will have a greater influence on human society than the horse." And when you look at history and the part that horses have played in history and how significant they were in the development of so many nations throughout the world, especially the United States, it's amazing. It's just absolutely amazing. Now, how in the world did you decide to become a veterinarian?
When I was a young man, I was working for a construction company in Denver, Colorado, and one of the projects of the many projects that we had was to build a veterinary clinic. At the time, I had just graduated from high school, and I was on my way to Colorado State University to embark upon a career in some form of wildlife management, conservation officer, game warden, they called it back in those days.
Mm-hmm.
And when I met a veterinarian named Bailey Cotton, a veterinarian had been in the federal service and then had built a very beautiful veterinary clinic in north of Denver, I became interested in this concept of becoming a doctor, not really knowing what that meant, but knowing that the only way to do that was to continue on and go to college. It's been my passion my entire professional career, and I've never looked back since.
Well, your book just states that so clearly on so many different levels. Let's talk about these wild horses. You were called in to be a consultant in this situation because there was about 2,000 wild horses on the White Sands Missile Range in New Mexico. Now, these are wild animals. They don't belong to anybody. Now, the Missile Range is quite sizable, but they were trapped because this is a 2-million-acre tract of desert and mountain. And when I read through your book and I saw through your written word what these animals were experiencing and how they were dying. And this was in the summer of 1994. Give us a little bit of an intro as to how you were brought into this and what was going on in 1994.
The die-off that we're going to talk about in a little bit occurred in the summer, June of 1994. And what precipitated the whole event was that every 4 or 5 decades in any high desert range, there are naturally going to be periods of extended drought. White Sands Missile Range was no different. There was an extensive one at the turn of the century, a drought at the turn of the century, and it caused much the same torment to the wildlife in the area. But back then, this huge tract of land on a place called the Jornada del Muerto, which is the journey of the dead men, was not fenced. And hence, the horses could leave, could make their way to the Rio Grande River, which was to the west, not more than 50 or so miles. Once the proving ground was developed in 1942 and expanded on into White Sands Missile Range in 1945. Horses couldn't migrate as they might have done before. And so whenever there was a drought, peril would occur. Most of the horse herds, of which there were four horse herds on this place, White Sands Missile Range, located in the northern 600,000 acres, there were four main herds, and one herd was fed primarily, was watered primarily on calcium carbonate springs. And when those springs began to dry up, many complications occurred. What brought Don Hoagland's attention to the die-off at White Sands Missile Range actually occurred 6 years earlier, when there was another potential beginning of the drought, but it was quite harsh, and that animal rights groups got wind of a potential auction that would occur from the from a harvest of horses, some 100 head, at that same White Sands Missile Range, that being in the late 1980s. So when I had worked for the prison system, and this famous fellow that we know of today and hear so much in the news, Bill Richardson, he was a congressman at the time in northern New Mexico, and I a practitioner in Santa Fe, New Mexico. And we became familiar with each other as a result of the prison inmate wild horse training centers that we developed in New Mexico. We trained some many tens of thousands of horses and had many hundreds, even into the thousands of prison inmates training wild horses for the Department of Interior and for the prison system. So I was off at working in a show with a man named Michael Eisner, the CEO of Disney, producing a Buffalo Bill Wild West show in Paris, when I was called to take a look at the fact that 122 horses showed up dead around that single middle watering hole in the northern part of the range. But what really caught my attention was a USA Today picture in which the emaciated mothers and older horses laying around a dried-up watering hole looked as though they'd been diseased for month after month after month, but the baby nursing horses were as healthy as they could be.
Amazing. Well, let's go back to something you just brought up, and that is you're working with this National Wild Horse Prison Inmate Program. You had three different facilities in New Mexico. You started this in 1987, and it was just so reminiscent to me of what they've done with the women in the Correctional Institute in the state of Washington with dogs. I mean, it really had an impact on developing self-esteem, et cetera. And you found this with the men. And horses are so special. And you make a comment in your book that horses are prey animals that watch and listen to everything. Every part of their sensory system, even if they're domesticated, is on alert. It's just innate within them. And when you're dealing with a wild Mustang, it's hyper, because that's their survival technique. And you talked about training, and for anybody that loves horses, I mean, I think they'd be absolutely mesmerized with your description in here. But the inmates, it wasn't just anybody that could work with these horses. How did you choose the inmates to work with these animals, and how would you recognize that this person was going to benefit from doing this?
The reason for putting the free-roaming horse, and I do correct myself when I say wild, because if you go to a forum to discuss the plight of the wild horse, wildlife biologists immediately commandeer the discussion and embargo all future discussion about the animal until we get rid of the word wild, so you'll hear me calling them free-roaming horses.
Okay.
But the free-roaming horse is a mirror of human behavior. It's an excellent barometer. It's probably the greatest lie detector that there is. In the state of New Mexico at the time, prison inmates were destroying each other. Some 34 prison inmates had killed each other. Mm. Others had escaped. The governor at the time was really concerned about prison inmates and idle time. The Department of the Interior had many thousands of free-roaming horses in captivity. The law stated that they couldn't be turned loose because of the wording of the Wild Free Roaming Horses and Burro Act. And so then Congressman Bill Richardson came to me and said, do you think we could put together a program like the one that's already established for a small 50 horses a year in Canyon City, Colorado? And how would we pick inmates was the very first question. And I would suggest first that the recruitment would be any inmate that wanted to participate would be a candidate. Then we would start talking to inmates about their potential and their ability and explain to them that there would be a thing called gentle cooperation. You wouldn't be allowed a rope. You wouldn't be allowed a whip. You would be inside a round corral that was enclosed. It was you and the horse with a trainer above you on a catwalk describing to you what he wanted, the trainer wanted you to do. What was the principle? That if you treat the horse with kindness, he's going to treat you with relative kindness. And until you develop a trust, you and the horse, you're not going to be able to get very close to that animal. So I will be able to tell you if you are lying to the horse or not. This concept that says the horse has a sixth sense and can tell when you're afraid or when you're aggressive, frankly, the horse can hear your heart rate. The horse can hear your respiratory rate. He can smell the pheromones that are coming from you that are engendered during fear, fear precipitating anger. And so the horse has a great heads up, given that it's got a sensitivity that might be 100 million times greater than ours, most certainly has a reaction time 4 times greater than we do. So placing a man with a horse, with a man in prison that had a potential anger management problem, most of the inmates that would come to the program had some form of violence in their background. If we placed them together, a man learned in a hurry, an inmate that is, learned in a hurry, that you were not going to take advantage of that horse, especially when you weren't given a weapon. So it was a logical win-win. It was extraordinarily successful. The state of New Mexico reports to me that some 10 years later, that instead of 8 out of 10 prisoners going back to prison, we see a very, very low rate, maybe even as low as 2 in 10 of those prisoners are back in prison 10 years later.
That's phenomenal. You talked about Jimmy Begay, who I found so fascinating to read about. This was a Native American, and he had an intuitive knack with horses, and it taught you some lessons, too. You, in doing this program, as an individual, you refined your own communication skills, didn't you?
I did. The horse taught me all about me.
That is amazing. Jimmy was special in what way? How did he work with horses?
Jimmy was a loner, and quite frankly, the free-roaming horse, even though they're gregarious and in the wild, tend to hang together in herds of anywhere from 8 to 20. They're pretty much loners within their social group. And so Jimmy identified with the horse. He believed in this Outlaws Helping Outlaws program. And he of course, was in for various crimes against humanity, none of which were horrifically violent, but he was involved in armed robbery at one time.
Mm-hmm.
And so Jimmy, being a loner himself, saw an identity in that horse. You know, after all, man, America was tamed from the back of a horse. We were literally built from the back of the horse at one time. And this relationship between man and horse, having gone on for some 5 or 6,000 years, has been a really solid relationship, from companion animal to beast of burden to pure friend, to even yard ornament, as we see in so many cases today. But Jimmy was able to identify with the horse because he saw himself in the horse. And somehow, he wanted to see them all free, just as he wanted to see himself free.
Mm-hmm. It's wonderful. Like I said, I found your book just mesmerizing. And I loved your story about Bubba. He was a 300-pound Hell's Angel, and he was fabulous with the babies, with the colts.
Yes, Bubba was a Hell's Angel biker that came in. He was in some kind of a trade-off between states with their prisoners. However that occurs, I'm not exactly sure. But Bubba was in prison for peddling marijuana cigarettes and bundles of marijuana. And he got a life sentence. He was never going to be able to get out. And was quite bitter as a result. And so, but Bubba identified with the horse. But you know, almost all of the inmates identified with the horse in ways that sometimes we take for granted when we're out free roaming ourselves in civilization. And so Bubba saw a baby horse, fell in love with that baby horse, and if it got the slightest nick, or as we say in the veterinary practice, knocked a little bark off the hide, that Bubba would be as frantic as a mother and a young child just going to the kindergarten playground. And Bubba showed all of the emotions. Often these men confined in prison had horrible childhood, a horrible childhood to each of them. And So in the long run, that may have been the only friend they ever had, and they identified with him. I have never sent a prisoner back into the compound itself for violence or for anger against the horse. Once in a while, they'd be angry against another man. And their participation rate was absentee list was zero.
Fabulous. It gave them a purpose. It gave them a place to put their healthy emotions to work and to bring a balance into their lives and something that they didn't have a place. They didn't know how to identify with in the outside world. Well, that's wonderful. Let's go back to the mystery of the horses that died at a watering hole. It was 122 horses. They had died from starvation, a lack of water. This was something that was appalling, but it ended up being a mystery that took you a while to solve. That must have been quite an uncomfortable experience, because part of this was a factor being on the missile base. You had to deal with military attitudes. There were people that were saying, well, let's just get rid of them, let's slaughter them. Other people that didn't want that at all. And here you go in the midst of all of it, and you meet some interesting characters. Tell us what evolved and how you had to work with that.
The horses on White Sands Missile Range were Army property. They were on Army property. And so that creates a distinction between a horse that's on a sanctuary, a reservation, as in a military reservation, or tribal lands, are different in the view of the law than are those that are protected by the Wild Free Roaming Horses and Burro Act. That act protected horses from 1971 on, the Wild Free Roaming Horse Act, protected horses on then Department of Interior lands, but it didn't protect any of the horses on those kind of sanctuaries or reservations as in a military reservation. So the horses on White Sands Missile Range were considered feral horses. And because of that, no law, state, federal, or local law protected them. The military made the, in my opinion, or my estimation, the correct decision by deciding to protect them. They looked in view of the fact that they were historically very important horses. But also, the military there decided public opinion wasn't going to accept that the horses were found another demise. And they were just as concerned and had predicted that something like this, 122 deaths, would occur. Without giving away the mystery and the details of what happens in the book, I can suggest this as a veterinarian. I was shocked to take a look at those healthy baby horses, the emaciated and dying others, a dry watering hole, and I have just enough science and medical background to know that that picture wasn't right. Why were those baby horses completely healthy? Next interesting thing is that from the time the range riders and the wildlife biologist Patrick Morrow found those horses in an overflight, went down to see them, and traveled to 90 minutes back to headquarters in radio silence, before they got to the general's office, the news of that die-off had hit the Dallas Morning News, our national news, AP newspaper. That shocked everybody that would come out. And then, of course, the world was apprised from that moment on.
Right. And Brigadier General Jerry Laws was the gentleman that decided that he was really going to see this handled in the right way. You had some interesting characters that you had to deal with there. One of them, his name was Les. Now, before we get into that, the 10-foot-tall mesquite trees, and there were various kinds of plant life that had nourished these animals. The free-roaming horse is very resourceful, and they will adapt. Their adaptability is just amazing, and I've read about this before. And in the area, there was the oryx bull, there was the aplomato falcon. There's all of these different species of animals that are on this White Sands missile base. I mean, we're talking about a huge, huge area, so there's a tremendous amount of life. But the oryx was able to survive this drought because they have what you described in your book, a kidney-like organ in their nose that conserves the water they get from plants. I mean, you have so much information here that is so interesting, but when you looked at a lot of the horses, you found that they had bloated bellies, and you said it was due to the heavy salt content of the water they were drinking as it mixed with forage high in indigestible fiber and low in protein. So they were being affected by the drought, by the salt content in the water, and the fact that they weren't able to get as much of their typical nourishment that they would have gotten in the environment.
That's true. Anytime the water content in a high desert, we're up around 4,000 feet, running all the way up to 9,000 more in some of the peaks, anytime a drought condition occurs, you're going to run into a decrease in the new forage or young plant life, and so you start to see the water pools become more saline, more salt, and when the animal takes that on, then he draws more water in, and it tends to draw the water from the body into the belly as well. So there was a certain amount of bloat going on. Long term, you start to see some other effects in the animals, except for that animal, the aurochs, which came originally from the Sahara Desert. It does have a kidney-like organ in its nose and helps it conserve water. But the horse, of course, doesn't have that advantage, and neither did the deer and other forms of wildlife. But the long-term effect is kidney failure of an animal that doesn't have enough water. Keep in mind that part of the mystery can be discussed at this point, and that is the mares who have yearling and two-year-old babies hanging around them, and they have this year's brand-new baby that might be 2 and 3 months old, won't leave their water supply. They're quite territorial. And those four main groups of horses, one in the north, one in the north-central, one in the west, and one in the mid-central of the whole missile range, didn't commingle very much. And so they're territorial. They stay around their watering hole. Now, if the mare doesn't leave the watering hole, then the babies aren't going to leave the watering hole, and the stallions most certainly aren't going to leave the watering hole. And as the populations of horses tended to aggregate around a watering hole that was drying up, the fury was of immense proportions. Irrespective of all that, the environment of White Sands Missile Range is very protected. For instance, you were given directions exactly where you could drive or where you couldn't drive, whether you had an ATV or a regular vehicle. And overflight, you would see 95% of that missile range has never had a track from any kind of vehicle on it.
Horses have phenomenal memories, contrary to, I think, legends that have been perpetuated by individuals. I've heard them through the years where they say horses are stupid. They're not. They are extremely intelligent, and if you're willing to be around them and willing to learn from them, they can teach you a lot. Now, you had to build special pens to get these horses in. And being free-roaming horses, what was the key element to getting those horses into the pen? Because you had a situation where you tried to pen them in, they escaped, and they went through an area of country that was next to impossible to get through, but they were thoroughly familiar with it. Tell us about that.
The free-roaming horse will go places that it wants to go. Sometimes you would see them traveling if you were in aircraft way up high, whether it was a helicopter or a fixed-wing aircraft, and they walk as straight as if they'd been shot by a laser, and one follows the other, and often it is the matriarch that's taking the herd from water to water and to feed. And it's not so unreasonable to believe that because she knows where it's at, everybody else is going to follow. The stallion really doesn't lead anybody. He just tries to keep his harem bunched up. If in herding the free-roaming horse in the wild, you have some target destination that you're heading for, it's far better that the matriarch in the herd think it's her idea to go there. So what you create a window of opportunity by blockading all other avenues, which works about 30% of the time. And so you have to get a little bit clever. If they think you're taking them to a place they don't want to go, it's amazing how they can smell a rat.
Mm-hmm.
If you herd a horse that's used to overflight, let's take White Sands, for instance. There's lots of aircraft flying all over the place, lots of missiles, lots of rockets. They go any direction that they want. And so the horse is quite used to that noise and that intimidation. So herding them is a little bit different than, say, out in the middle of Nevada somewhere where the horse might not have ever seen an aircraft before. So it was hard to push him with that. Hence, we had to have ATV four-wheel drive to insert in between each of the three helicopters that we used at a time. And then we would only have flight time of about 40 minutes in between having to fuel helicopters. So if you had 25 miles that you needed to drive herds, groups of 8, 30 together, and you had to get it all done in 25 miles, some of the horses would have gone quite a distance. It was nice to burn off some of their jet fuel along the way, but part of the issue was to protect the baby horses, and that was one of the big fears that I had as a veterinarian, is how far can you push a young horse? We tried to select mares and babies out, but you had to be really careful. Was that, in fact, the baby for the given mare that you pulled out of the herd with an ATV or even with a helicopter that you forced one away from the herd and along the distance? So many times in this drought in particular, we would have to cross an old playa or a dried-up waterbed. Those horses knew that thing to have that place to have water most of the time. And so when we drove a herd of 450 toward that waterbed, we knowing that there was no water in it, but there wasn't any way they were going to cross it. And even though we had three helicopters and many ATVs and people on the ground, there was no way those horses were going to cross that waterbed. When they turned around, they scattered like quail.
You talked at the very first part of your book about a colt that you came upon when you first went to the White Sands Missile Range, and it was blind, and you took it under your wing, and it was given a lot of love and attention, and it was really doing well. Now, the horses, and I'm digressing for just a moment here, the horses were herded up. A few were left there. But this particular colt ended up dying a year later. And you and everyone tried to do everything you could, and you brought a fact out that I thought was fascinating, that this colt died not because it had not been well taken care of, but that because it had not been nursed by its mother, it didn't have the antibodies in its system to help it go through the growing transition it would grow through naturally in the wild. And so when it was eating foods that were introduced, and that was a challenge for you, was to introduce certain foods so that the wild horses would fare well, because it was going to, you know, introduce grasses or whatever it was that you had there. But when you said that, I thought how so very true that is with any mammal, just about any creature that has to go through that nursing process. The mother's body, if it's healthy, will provide that baby, whether it is horse or human or whale, it doesn't make any difference, with natural antibodies that allow the body to grow and defend itself against microorganisms that can invade the system. Your book is just incredible, Don. I think that you give so much information in it. The fact that the horses were rescued, you talk about the homes, and you solve the mystery of the watering hole, which I thought was quite profound. So I'm not going to tell you folks what it is. You've got to get his book, Nobody's Horses, The Dramatic Rescue of the White Herd of White Sands. Now, Don, I know we're just about out of time. You have a website called nobodyshorses.com.
Yes, ma'am.
What
on nobodyshorses.com, you can see some of the book reviews. You can see some of the pictures of the actual participants. You can hear a review or two done online. And you can even email me at this site. I do want to tell you that I'm very fortunate in that one day this will be a feature film. I'm working with Joan Waldman, a former general counsel for Walt Disney Company, and chemistry.com. a music studio in the Hollywood area, and as yet I will remain unnamed as to who the actors and actresses will be about it, but they are high-profile
Well, people. I can tell you, this would make a phenomenal movie. The book is just awesome. The information you give about Nobody's Horses, for anybody who's a horse lover, by golly, get them this book, because it will give them perspectives that will touch their heart and their mind, but also good, solid information about what these animals what they give to us and why. We need to be aware of them, protect their habitat, and to make sure that they have a place and a space in this experience of life. Don Hoglund, that's H-O-G-L-U-N-D. Go to his website, nobodyshorses.com. Don, thanks so much for being my guest today.
Thank you, Donna.
This is Donna Sebo. We're taking a break. Don't go away. Lots of good stuff to share with you today, and it'll be coming up right after the break. Donna Sebo here.
Do you want to lose weight? Do you deal with diabetes, high blood pressure, osteoporosis, or chronic pain? Do you want to know one of Dr. Perricone's 7 secrets to beauty, health, and longevity? Do you have 15 minutes a day to look and feel better? Then let me introduce you to TTAP, the workout that works. For the beginner or expert exerciser, learn from physical training specialist Teresa Tapp how, in just 15 minutes a day, you can burn fat and sugar, build strong bones and muscles, and lose inches fast with no equipment or jumping. Visit the TTAP website, ttap.com, or call 1-800-342-0717 to learn how. That's TTAPP.com. We'll help you lose inches, look good, and feel fabulous at TTAP. 1-800-342-0717, ttap.com.
Are you concerned about nutrition? Do you work hard to eat right, try to feed yourself and your family nutritious food? Well, you'll want to know about glyconutrients. What are they? These are sugars that are present in nature, however, we're not getting them in our food anymore. Scientific study is proving that these sugars are necessary for all cellular and immune system function. Over 20,000 studies are conducted each year on glycoforms alone. These are the sugar protein structure that line each and every cell of the body. 4 out of the last 8 Nobel Prizes in physiology have been awarded for research in the area of cellular communication and how these sugars work in the body. This is Donna Sebo. Every day I bring to you information that will empower and light up your life. I would like to invite you to visit my website, DelphiInternational.com, and find out more about these glyconutrients. That's DelphiInternational.com. Go to my website, go to the left side of the screen, tap on the button that says glyconutrients. MIT's Technology Review, February 2003, states that glycomics is one of the 10 emerging technologies that will change the world. Education is the key to advancement of understanding and making our lives better. Visit my site, DelphiInternational.com. Go to the left side of the screen and tap on the button that says glyconutrients. I know it'll make a difference for you, as it has for me.
Hi, this is Donna Sebo, and telephone lines are open. If you would like to chat with me directly, I'd be delighted to light up your life with a little bit of intuitive insight. Here are the telephone numbers to call into, 877-876-5227. That's 877-876-5227. Canadians, 888-815-9756. Also, 530-876-3222 is our direct line. Now, when you call in, all I need from you is your first name or your initial, and then let me do my thing, and after that, you're welcome to ask me about anything that you like. Also, if you'd like to have or like to give a comment about the horses when you call in, and I ask you for your name, just give me your name and let me know that you'd like to make a comment about what we were discussing about the wild horses. That would be a delight. So anyway, 877-876-5227, 888-815-9756, and 530-876-3222. Now, I do want to give out some information. Next week, I'm going to be broadcasting from Fairbanks, Alaska, and Anchorage, Alaska. For those of you who are listening in from that part of the country, while I'm in Alaska, and you can go on to my website to find out the numbers you can call if you'd like to meet with me privately, because I will be doing private consultations while I'm up there. But I will be up there, and we will be having our interviews and our shows just as normal, because no matter where I go, the microphone and the radio show goes with me. So we're live from wherever. So the broadcast all of next week will be coming from Alaska. Also, I wanted to let you know there's some events coming up that I'm going to be a participant in. One is the Boeing Parapsychology Expo that's right here in Kent, Washington. Yes, so for those of you who are listening in the Washington area, I am anticipating being a part of that wonderful event. It's being held at the Kent Commons. If you will go into my website to the newsletter, you will find all of the pertinent information, the address, and all of that other good stuff. But you can go to the Boeing, it's called BEPC, the Boeing Expo Parapsychology Group, and you're going to just, you know, going to be able to find out everything that you need to know. It's in my newsletter, and it'll be a one-day event, and that's on the 27th of September. So I will be there, and I'm going to have all kinds of books available to you. If you would like to pick up one, you're going to have a chance to do that. And then I am going to be broadcasting from Tampa, Florida. We're going to be doing an interview with Teresa Tapp next week, and we'll be going into more detail on that. But I have been invited to go to Tampa, Florida, and to be involved with her retreat, and I am going to be broadcasting live from that event. And we're going to be talking with actual people, yes, yes, real live human beings. You're going to be hearing their story about this phenomenal, phenomenal wellness program that she is offering, and I'm going to be right there, and I'll be able to share those details with you. So there's a lot of exciting stuff that's coming up. Also, I'm going to be at the Wisdom Festival the 17th, 18th, and 19th of October. Now, this is being held in San Francisco, and this is an event where people are coming in from all over the country to participate. There's vendors with products and services. I'll be there doing many consultations, also speaking. There are going to be special speakers coming in from different parts of the country as well, and I'll be having them as guests on the show. So all of that is going to be coming up in October. So if you go in, if you did not receive my newsletter, you can go in, see what my itinerary is. Also, the broadcasts that are coming up with some other people, with other programs, and I've been invited to be a guest. So all of that information is going to be available to you. And you can go in, check on the newsletter button, and you'll have the latest of what's happening with me and where I'm going to be and what I'm going to be doing, and all of that is there for your reading convenience. In the interim, give me a buzz if you'd like to chat, 877-876-5227, 888-815-9756, also 530-876-3222. Kelly Spencer has a wonderful poem, just a little short poem. I like it. It's got the most gorgeous photograph with it. She says, "The days will grow shorter soon, and September nights will turn chill, but the hollyhocks in my garden say it's summer still." Boy, here in the Pacific Northwest, we are seeing fall. Yes, it's come in a little bit earlier than usual. The trees, many of them are already turning color, so I think we're going to have a wet winter this year, and maybe a wee bit chillier than what we had last year, but definitely a wet one. I wanted to talk about a father and how reading brought him, he was a stepdad, and his stepdaughter together. Books are wonderful things. And I have had a passion about them for as far back as I can remember, and obviously I am still enjoying my passion when I read 400 to 600 books a year. And I read them because it expands my world, just like I was talking with Dawn about Nobody's Horses. When you can read information from someone's perspective, it broadens your world. You may not agree with everything, you don't have to. But the only way we can grow and expand as people is when we're open and receptive to learning. And it makes life, one, more interesting, but two, it develops a level of communication and perceptiveness that I don't think you are going to have otherwise. Unless you're the type of person that's in the financial position where you can travel and go to so many different parts of the world, but believe me, when you can read, everything is available to you. And it's a sad statement to make that so many adults in the United States do not enjoy reading. So many people do not have good reading skills, and I have encountered many of them, all ages, whether they're teenagers to people that are in their 80s and 90s. you'll ask them if they read. They say, no, I don't have the time to read. Yet they'll sit in front of a television and watch it, and then they'll say, I'm bored with my life. But what is it? It's when you don't have good reading skills. Well, it brings to mind, and I'm going to be sharing this story with you about this father-daughter situation with reading, but I recall sharing a story about a man who was in his 90s. He was 93 years old, and he had never learned to read. And he had had a very successful life, believe it or not. He was extremely intelligent. He had provided a very, very good living for his family, and he just was a marvelous person in the community. But he hadn't been able to do very much as far as advancing in his position of life because he could never read. Well, one day, a young man, now he's in his early 90s, 93, a young man comes up to his front porch. He lived in the southern area of the United States, and this was a black man, and he said, I meet this young man, and he comes up to me, and he said, sir, I am a teacher, and I'm offering a program at the local library for people that would like to learn to read. And so he's talking to this gentleman, and he said, I'd love to invite you to my class. And so this gentleman, who's 93 years old, he says, let me think about this. He said, I'd learned so many things throughout my life, but one of the things I'd never learned to do was to read. So he said, I figured I was still around because the good Lord wanted me to learn something else, and that was how to read. Do you know, he went to this class at his local library. He really liked this young man, and in six months, he was reading, and he was reading at an adult level. He said it just changed his life tremendously. Now, I don't know where he is at this time in life, and if he is still alive, by golly, I'm sure he's still reading. But he said he reflected on it, and his regret was that he had never done or made the effort to learn how to read earlier because it just enriched his world tremendously, and this is at the age of 93. So if you know of anyone that has reading difficulties, encourage them to become a part of reading classes, to become involved with the written word, because they can learn how to read comfortably and easily. And it will give them a freedom and a joy in their life that is just absolutely unending. And the local library has so many people that donate their time. There are all kinds of classes, but encourage this. If you have children in school and you find that they're bored, they don't want to read certain things, all right, then get a material that they're interested in. I have a friend who is a teacher, and she dealt with the incorrigibles and with students, especially teenagers. And one young man came into her class one day, and she had to deal with him, and she said, you know, you're not going to graduate from high school unless you can read. Well, he hated reading. So she struck a bargain with him. She found out his interests were in mechanics. And she said, if I get you books on mechanics, and his eyes just got real bright. She said, if I get you books on mechanics, will you be willing to learn and to read these books? So she went out and got magazines because he agreed to do so. She got these magazines, and she said within just a matter of a few months, this kid's reading level was right where it was supposed to be. She said it was where his interests were. And I think of Tim O'Brien yesterday from Ripley's Believe It or Not. Teachers are using Ripley's books because kids are interested in it. And if you have a child that's frustrated with reading, don't try to put them into a box. Find out what their interests are and bring materials in that are going to cultivate that interest. This young man that was with our family's friend, he cultivated such a skill with reading that he was able to go on to a vocational school and become a first-class mechanic. This is what he loved. He wanted to do that more than anything else. He wasn't interested in Shakespeare or what have you, and that's okay. But learning to read is so important, so do support that with the people that you love. Now, I know we're getting ready to go on a break. This is Donna Siebel. When we come back, I'm going to talk about a stepfather and a stepdaughter that ended up developing a wonderful relationship because of the magic of books. Give me a buzz if you'd like to chat, 877-876-5227 or 888-815-9756. Also, 530-876-3222. We're going to come back in just a moment, and just know we're going to share a lot of things, so don't want you to miss any of it. We'll be right back.
As a counselor, Donna Sebo is available for private consultations by appointment. These can be done by telephone or in person. If you'd like to schedule an appointment with Donna, call 253-582-5604 or 800-872-8852. That's 253-582-5604 or outside of Pierce County, 800-872-8852.
Enter the magical world of God's kiss.
He sees a large open area of valley ground covered with a thick green grass. In the open space are many other children and animals. All kinds of animals. And all of the animals are talking. He can understand every word they are saying.
God's Kiss is a beautifully illustrated children's book about a young boy's journey into a valley with children and animals from all over the world. They are gathering together to experience the wonder of love and beauty that will affect their lives forever. A talking book audio narrated by the author Donna Sebo accompanies this wonderful storybook, creating a special magic all of its own. This book package makes a wonderful gift for those special children in your life, ages 3 to 10. God's Kiss book and talking book audio are only $19.95, plus shipping and handling. And the author Donna Sebo will autograph and personalize your book if you request it. Call 800-872-8852. You can also order through Donna Sebo's website, www.delphiinternational.com.
Hi, this is Donna Sebo. Give me a buzz if you'd like to chat, 877-876-5227 or 888-815-9756. Also 530-876-3222. Tomorrow we're going to be talking about a wonderful publication, To Be or Not To Be. And this is about the little buzzing buzzers. You know, the little honeybees? Yes. So we're going to be buzzing about the bees tomorrow. John Pimberthy is going to be my guest. It is delightful. This is a very positive, upbeat story that I know you'll enjoy. And then on Friday, we're going to be talking about a phenomenal woman. I was unaware of her. Her name is Frances Yates, but she was recognized as a world-class scholar in her day, and this is about her life. And she wrote about the Hermetic tradition. It was a level of metaphysics at that time that laid the groundwork for a lot of what we understand today. So we've got some wonderful, wonderful guests. I don't want you to miss any of them. Be sure you tell your friends about the show, too. And remember, the shows are archived for your listening convenience. You can go in whenever you want and listen to the programs if you missed them. We have some great people here on the Donna Sebo Show, and it's my delight to be able to bring them to you. So tell your friends about it and know that they are available to you any time of the day or night. You get bored, you're working on something, it's so mundane, you think it's going to drive you nuts. Hey, put this in the background and listen to it. That's what it's there for in the archives section here on the Donna Sebo Show. Now, this is about Ptolemy Tompkins. He is a man that in 1994 ended up having a brand new family. His wife, Rebecca, she lived in Greenwich Village in New York, and she had a 7-year-old daughter named Mara. And he said, in New York, so often apartments are rather small because space is pretty hard to come by. And he thought after they got married and they decided that it was her place they were going to move into, he wondered, where in the world am I going to put everything? And he had some of his greatest possessions, his most prized possessions, were books. And so when he went into the apartment, he thought, where am I going to put my books? Now, what was interesting is that his wife, Rebecca, and her daughter, Mara, were readers. And it's always tough when you come into a family and you have to develop a relationship with the kids. And they're not babies, so you're not going to be working from that. But this is, you know, a youngster that is very intelligent. She reads a lot. But in her mind, her mother had brought an alien into her space. And he said he could feel exactly what was going on with her because it had happened to him when he was younger. And, man, the first time that she barked back at him when they had an encounter, she said, "You're not my father." And he just said, "You're right, I'm not your dad. But I'm right here. I can be your friend." Now, he said, when he was growing up, he had sort of been a dreamy kind of kid. He was solitary, and he was happy just being involved with books and things that meant a lot to him. But Mara was different. Mara did her reading between visits to friends' homes, and she didn't put a lot of time into reading. But he said he often wondered about the material that she read, and he said, "You know, I looked at this, and I thought about it. When I was growing up, this stuff that she's reading is so far removed from what I was interested in when I was younger." He said there was too many words, not enough stuff. He loved dinosaurs when he was growing up. Let's get real here. How many girls are going to fall in love with dinosaurs? I've known a few, but there's not that many that get that excited about them. Sharks, that was his interest when he was growing up. It wasn't Mara's interest. However, when he started bringing his books into the house, and he started going through them, you know, when you put things away, when you've packed things up because you're going to be moving, sometimes you forget what you have. And when he was pulling out these books, he found Farley Mowat's book, Never Cry Wolf. He had been carrying that around for years. He had had it from the time he was a kid. And he said, "You know what? I had not read that book for a long time." So he said it was really important to him when he started going through this, how he found some books had been given to him by his stepmother. And he said, "You know what? My stepmother, when I was growing up, had introduced me to all kinds of books and authors that I ended up loving a great deal." And he said, "It got so I developed a relationship with my stepmother because of these wonderful books. We had something to talk about. We became friends. We weren't enemies." And so what he did, because of this experience of opening up these boxes of books that he had had packed away for so long, he realized that he had a venue where he could reach Mara in a very special way. So he started paying attention to the books that she was interested in. And he said many times he noticed that if Mara really liked a book, she'd reread it. He said she'd take it with her wherever she was. And he said, "I noticed I had felt the same way about certain books when I was growing up." So what he did, he stopped at a Barnes & Noble, went into the kids' section, and just picked up some titles that he thought, because he had paid attention to what she was reading, that he thought she might be interested in. And he said, by golly, he found one that she just fell in love with. And after that, he started buying her books regularly. But he'd go to rummage sales, flea markets, bookstores. But he said every time he shared a book with her, he got to know her a little bit better. And she was growing up, and when she turned 14, he found a square package at home one day when he got there. And he said, "What's this?" And his wife said, "Well, this is for you." But you know what? It was a pictorial book on sharks. And inside was an inscription saying to Tomi, "Happy Father's Day with love from Mara." She had been paying attention to what he liked, and when she was 14, gave him that wonderful gift. He said, "You know, books are funny things. They have a way of making you feel right at home." A wonderful way to build a relationship between an adult and a child. Keep that in mind. It might make a difference in your family. Find out about what the interest of the youngster is and or the adult, and take it from there. This is Donna Siebel. I know we're out of time. I'm so delighted you were spending your time with me. Don't forget, tomorrow we are going to be buzzing around with some beekeeping information that I think you're going to enjoy. This is Donna Sebo. Don't forget, a book offers freedom. And the more you enjoy reading, the more freedom you can experience in your life and in your space, because it opens your mind, it opens your attitude to new vistas, new opportunities. Pick one out. Get busy reading. Enjoy. This is Donna Sebo. Remember, always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. We'll see you tomorrow, same time, same place, right here at bbsradio.com, The Donna Sebo Show. Bye for now.
You have been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. If you would like a copy of today's broadcast, send $10 to The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497-0272. Be sure to put the date of the broadcast in your request. If you are not able to be a part of today's program, join Donna and her guests Monday through Friday, and she will be here to take your calls. Thank you for listening and being part of our program. Have a wonderful day.